Welcome to Inside Ag. I'm your host, Greg Deering. Today I'm joined by U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service biologist Clay Nichols. He's here to talk about the potential threatened listing for the lesser prairie chicken in Kansas and other states. Clay, glad to have you here and welcome to the program.
Yeah, thank you for having us today, Greg. Thanks for the invite and appreciate the opportunity to talk to you and your listeners.
So to start off, this is essentially the second time in less than a decade the lesser prairie chicken has been considered for a threatened listing here in Kansas. How did we get to this point? And can you walk us through the process and how long it will take to reach a decision on its actual listing as threatened here?
Just some quick background there is that, you know, how do we get to this point? When you look at the lesser prairie chicken and considerations for listing under the Endangered Species Act, it's actually quite a long timeline. The Fish and Wildlife Service received our original petition to list the lesser prairie chicken all the way back in 1995. In 1998, we concluded that it was warranted for protections under the ESA, but we had other higher priorities. Is precluded by other higher priorities. So we kind of put it on the back burner for a little bit. Our workload was really high. We moved through and we get up into the 2000s, and specifically in 2008, the threats to lesser prairie chicken continued to increase on the landscape. And so we started looking at things more seriously. And by the time we get to 2012, we proposed to list the lesser prairie chicken as a threatened species. And as everybody knows, in 2014, we finalized that listing decision. So kind of you fast forward through that period a little bit and get to a court, an adverse court decision on the listing, which vacated the listing rule. And then shortly after that, we received a new petition to list the lesser prairie chicken again. So when you receive that new petition, is what that ultimately means is it starts a few timelines. So we received that new petition in, I believe, it was September of 2016. When the Fish and Wildlife Service receives a petition, we have 90 days to make what we call a 90-day finding there. And it's just this real quick cursory look at the petition. We try to decide, does it, you know, it's a pretty low bar. We just take a quick look and say, does it provide enough detail that we should look at this and spend a little more time on it. We concluded that it did provide enough detail, enough justification that maybe we should look at this again. So we published our positive 90-day finding. And what that did was it started the clock on our 12-month finding. And so that's what we recently came out with, our 12-month petition finding. And we found that it warrants protections under the ESA, and we're proposing to list it. And so it's kind of been a long storied path there with lesser prairie chicken, and how we got to where we're at. But we are proposing, and that's just the start of this process, the proposal. What's next is we're in the midst of a public review and comment period, which this is a really important time. It's the opportunity for the Fish and Wildlife Service to hear thoughts and perspectives on the listing. And so we're trying to solicit as much public input as we can on the process and the proposal. And so we're in the midst of that right now. Once the public comment period closes, we also held two virtual public hearings. The second one was last night. The first one was on July 8th. And so we make it through all of that, make it through a public comment period. And then the job in front of the Fish and Wildlife Service is to take all of that information that we gather throughout this period, compile it, consider it all in the broader context of what we've already considered, add all that additional information in, and then think about the decision again. And so no decision has been made, no final decisions made, and we'll reconsider all the information, all of the appropriate statutory and policy requirements that we have to follow. And then at the end of this time frame, which would be 12 months from the proposed listing, so we proposed it on June 1st, 2021. So, you know, approximately June 1st, 2022, we'll need to make a final finding. And that final finding has a few potential outcomes. We could say, you know, it's not warranted for listing based upon a review of all that, or we could finalize the listing rule as proposed, or we could change it up. We could list it range-wide as threatened, list it range-wide as endangered. We could list still two distinct population segments, both as threatened. Like, all of those options are still on the table for us, and we still have a lot of flexibility. So that's kind of, you know, a brief history, ESA history, and then kind of the next steps that we're looking forward to in the next, you know, 11 and a half or 10 and a half, 11 months now.
I think it's important to remember that this is still in the process of being considered as threatened or potentially endangered here. And I do want to ask you about the distinct population in Kansas. Obviously, the listing could be for a threatened designation, whereas in New Mexico and Texas, they're looking at a potential endangered designation. How did you arrive at or split those two populations? And then how does that affect this process?
Yeah, so that's a good question. So let me first start and reflect back to 2012. So 2012, again, we proposed the species as threatened range-wide, so just one status under the Endangered Species Act. We ended up finalizing that listing rule. So there was no two population discussion in that final listing rule. It was just the lesser prairie chicken as a whole, wherever it occurs, was listed as threatened. But some quick background here is that the Endangered Species Act, specifically in the ESA, says that the secretary, and talking about Secretary of Interior, shall determine if any species is an endangered or a threatened species. The ESA goes on further to provide that a species includes any subspecies of fish or wildlife or plants and any distinct population segment of any species. So it goes on to further define what can be listed as a species under ESA. So that term distinct population segment comes directly out of the Endangered Species Act. And we have some criteria that we have to meet for a population to be considered a distinct population segment. So to be considered a distinct population segment, you kind of have to meet two criteria. First, the population has to be separate or discrete from other populations. And it's an and there, not an or. So you have to meet both of these. And it must have significant biological or ecological value. So once we go through that and determine that a population meets those criteria, we can then determine independent listing status for that population on its own, as opposed to looking at it range-wide as a species. So since making our 2014 decision, our main difference here is that there was additional genetic analysis had been completed, indicating that there's clear genetic differentiation between the Chenery Oak ecoregion, which is the far south there occurring in Texas and eastern New Mexico, and the remainder of the range. These genetic differentiation, along with the geographic separation and the uniqueness of the ecological setting, kind of provided all of that justification needed to say, you know, these things are probably operating independently and do meet the criteria to be considered distinct population segments. So again, some of that information existed in 2014, but not all of it. And we had additional analyses, genetic analyses completed independent of the Fish and Wildlife Service. It was just some researchers did it, a really thorough job in 2016 of analyzing the genetic structure of the lesser prairie chicken populations across the range.
Some great background, and I appreciate that. We'll get into something I think our listeners may be a little bit more interested in, and that is, if it actually does end up being listed in Kansas, what are the potential liabilities that farmers and ranchers could face for continuing practices that they're doing today? And how do they avoid those liabilities, or what do they need to be prepared to do if it is indeed listed?
First of all, I'll take a quick background. So if it is listed, if the listing is finalized, then is what would be prohibited is take as defined by the Endangered Species Act. And so there's a bunch of examples of what take is, but you know, for lesser prairie chicken, most of the big take issues that we would worry about would be forms of habitat loss and fragmentation. And so I say all that to habitat loss and fragmentation, as well as degradation of the habitat. And I say that to transition into the implications of that for farmers. That's the easy one to address. So I'll take farmers first, and then we'll move on to ranchers. So farmers, there will be few to no implications to continuing farming operations on existing row crop ag in Kansas. And that's for a really good reason, is that, you know, the potential for impacts to lesser prairie chickens from continuation of agricultural practices on existing ag land is minimal, because ag land doesn't provide the necessary components to support lesser prairie chicken habitat. So we already don't consider those ag lands as habitat. And so continuing to farm those lands has no implications and no bearings on long-term conservation for the lesser prairie chicken. In fact, in the proposed 4D rule, for the northern distinct population segment, which includes all the birds in Kansas, we have included an exemption just explicitly stating that just continuing to farm existing agricultural land, row crop ag, you're good to go. You don't really need anything. You don't need to come talk to the service. You don't need to talk to anybody. Just keep doing what you're doing. The potential, there could be, and I say so, minimal impacts for farmers, with one potential caveat. There could be a potential impact if a landowner wishes to break out native range land or grassland that is lesser prairie chicken habitat and convert that over to row crop ag. In that case, there could be some detrimental impacts on lesser prairie chickens, and we could look at different options, permitting options under the ESA to allow those actions to move forward. But there could be a permitting option that would be needed to explore there. That's for rand or for farmers. Farmers is fairly straightforward one. The impact's probably pretty minimal, if any, for the most part. For ranchers, livestock grazing does have the potential to impact lesser prairie chickens. So, and it can impact lesser prairie chickens in a variety of different ways. Livestock grazing is a tool which can be used to shape and manage grasslands and shrublands in ways that result in different outcomes. So depending upon the approach taken, livestock grazing has the ability to significantly influence habitat suitability for lesser prairie chickens. When managed to produce habitat conditions which are required by the lesser prairie chicken, grazing is actually an invaluable tool for managing healthy prairie ecosystems. And again, not only is it compatible, it's needed to manage healthy rangelands out there, which lesser prairie chicken relies upon. However, if grazing is managed in a way that is focused on maximizing short-term cattle production, this could result in rangeland that is uniformly overutilized throughout the management area, leaving limited residual cover for spring nesting and decreasing vegetative heterogeneity. So this could have some negative effects on the lesser prairie chicken by decreasing habitat quality. The results can even be further exacerbated by drought. So grazing management that alters plant communities, it could even in extreme cases alter a plant community to the point to where it no longer provides lesser prairie chicken habitat. So the grazing is a tough one because it's really site specific, and it's really hard to make like these general statements about what the true impact would be. And so the biological response of the lesser prairie chicken and the habitat to grazing is highly dependent upon a lot of variables, one of the primary variables being precipitation patterns. So I ramble on quite a bit there on the grazing front to say the service fully understands that 95% of the lesser prairie chicken's range is private land. That, future conservation of lesser prairie chicken only occurs, regardless of the listing status, only occurs with continued support from private landowners, and specifically ranchers who are shepherds of that land that's providing habitat for lesser prairie chicken. But we also acknowledge that if done in certain ways, it could have detrimental impacts on lesser prairie chicken. So I go down that whole path to say there are some potential impacts to ranchers and in some areas, and there are existing conservation options in place where landowners can enroll and get coverage under the ESA. So our first suggestion is we are always encouraging landowners to participate in those existing programs. But if there's not a program that really meets their needs, we have a lot of flexibility under the ESA to provide that certainty that landowners are looking for while meeting the needs of the lesser prairie chicken.
obviously, I think one of the big questions that farmers may have, they're largely exempted under that 4D rule. I think CRP is probably their biggest question. If they've got ground already enrolled in that, and you're looking at grain prices going up, you're looking to break that out as your contract ends, that's going to be allowed since it's not native prairie. It's been farmed before. Is that correct?
Yeah. So to qualify under the routine ag exemption, there's two criteria that land must meet. First, it must meet the definition of cropland as defined in the CFR. And those lands enrolled in CRP would meet that definition. But the second criteria they have to meet is they must have been, tilled or planted or harvested within the previous 5 years of the proposed action. And so because of that, those lands won't meet that, because most CRP contracts are 10 to 15 years. And so all of a sudden they won't meet that. So a landowner's concern, you're exactly right. The concern from landowner is going to be, so I enroll my land in CRP for 10 years. Let's say everything goes good. All of a sudden lesser prairie chickens are using my land and my contract expires and I want to break it out and put it back in row crop agriculture. Can I do that? Or am I going to be prohibited from doing that because now I have lesser prairie chicken habitat? Fish and Wildlife Service is a huge fan of the CRP program specifically. We think for lesser prairie chickens, it's the primary conservation program, which provided a lot of uplift for the species. And so we want to do everything we can to encourage, not put roadblocks in the way of participating in that program. In 2014, when the species was listed, we had worked with FSA and under the ESA, under a Section 7 consultation. Basically, what we did is we put together ESA coverage for the entire implementation of every CRP contract. And after that contract ended, if the landowner wanted to break it out, we also covered that activity as well. So it wasn't covered under the 4B. It was just covered under a different ESA regulatory mechanism. Once the land is broken out from CRP, now all of a sudden it meets the two criteria to qualify for the routine ag exemption. And again, it meets the definition of cropland, and now it's been tilled within the previous 5 years because now it's been broken back out to cropland. So that's how we handled it in 2014. The service and FSA have been speaking on this topic very recently and trying to get there. I think at least my expectation is that we largely get to that same place again, and we have a clear mechanism for landowners to say, Don't be afraid to enroll in CRP. It's not like you're going to get trapped in it and not be able to break your land back out. There's going to be clear mechanisms that provide you certainty of what the path forward looks like. And that path forward includes the option to convert it back to row crop agriculture.
Or those with grazing lands, do you have any sense of how many of them have compliant conservation plans already in place versus how many might need that if a listing is successful here, and what's kind of the staffing like available to them to get those stood up in a timely manner?
That's actually a great question that I've been spending quite a bit of time on. So it varies across the range. I know here we're thinking about Kansas landowners that they're across the range, in New Mexico and Texas and Oklahoma, there's existing CCAAs in place that have a lot of enrollment already in those programs. And so we're talking almost 3 million acres total just in those three states. But Kansas doesn't have a CCAA right now for landowners to enroll in and to cover, grazing practices. So what they do have is they do have, the NRCS and USDA programs and those Farm Bill programs. And we're working with those agencies to ensure that there will be coverage in place for those landowners. We already have some coverage in place and we'll continue. We don't have a great handle on exactly what percentage of landowners are covered by, those USDA programs and what are not. But we do know that there are landowners that are not covered by those programs. And again, if the species becomes listed and a landowner wishes to participate, our goal is to make sure there's options for them in place. And so we've been talking with several different partners over the for a while now, but I, as recently as yesterday, had a conversation with conservation partners about developing additional options for landowners. one option is not really an option. So you can't say there's options if there's only one option there. So a landowner needs to have the ability to choose to choose between programs and what fits his or her needs the best. And so that's really the direction we're trying to go. And it does require some time, does require some staffing. But I think all the conservation partners I've talked to are fully embedded and ready to roll up their sleeves to ensure that those options exist for landowners in Kansas.
Other than the distinct population segment, is there anything different about this listing process than the prior one?
Yeah, there's some small, I shouldn't characterize it as small because it may not be small to some people. There are some differences. And specifically, I'll think a little bit about Kansas here and think about the implications for landowners in Kansas. And the primary difference that exists is that when you think about the 2014 4D rule, and that's that's the section 4D rule that defined what take looks like and what it didn't look like. So and this current version of the proposed 4D rule, there's some differences between those two that I can highlight. And the first difference that I would point to would be that the proposed 4D rule in the Northern DPS this time does not contain an exemption for NRCS actions or the WAFWA range-wide plan. Those were included in the 2014 4D rule and not in this one. So I'll talk about both of those independently really quick. When the species was listed in 2014, the NRCS language in the previous 4D rule was problematic as Section 4D of the ESA cannot relieve a federal agency of its responsibilities under Section 7. So I know that's a lot of ESA jargon, but basically is what it says is like, you can include language in the 4D rule for federal actions, but we still have to go through Section 7 consultation. So why would you do that? And so it created a lot of internal questions as well as external questions from landowners saying, why are you doing Section 7 consultation with NRCS? It's already been exempted through Section 4D, and it created this long-winded policy explanation by the Fish and Wildlife Service that everybody's eyes glazed over, and it just created a lot of confusion. So this time around, we said, why double work? Let's not include the language in the 4D, and let's do Section 7, because we're going to have to do Section 7 to get that coverage anyways. So we didn't include the NRCS language this time. But we are committed to continuing, and we already have a lot of stuff in place for NRCS. We've already done a lot of that legwork over the past couple of years, but to continue to work with NRCS to ensure all their actions that they want coverage for are covered under the ESA. So now I'll shift and talk a little bit about the range-wide, the Western Association for Fish and Wildlife Agencies, and for short, I'll call that WAFWA, Range-Wide Conservation Plan for Lesser Prairie Chicken. So that plan contains a mitigation framework within the plan, and basically is what it allowed voluntary participation, and people could enroll and thinking about industry, mainly oil and gas and wind industry and folks like that could enroll. And if they're negatively impacting lesser prairie chicken habitat, pay money voluntarily, WAFWA would take that money and go enroll landowners and provide conservation to offset those impacts. And so last time around, that plan was brand new, really didn't have much participation in it, but we saw some value in it and it had some good promise. So we provided a 4D exemption for that. Due to recent concerns that were identified in a 2019 audit report, which is available online and talking about the effectiveness of conservation delivery and the financial status of the range-wide plan, in the current version, we did not propose to exempt the participants in the plan who are not covered. Instead, we're soliciting public input on this issue, and we ask the question. We say, hey, we're looking for some input on what you may think. Should this be exempted? Should it not? Allow us some time to consider it further, number one, and allow WAFWA some time to continue working to improve the plan and strategy and try to work out some of the issues that we've identified. So those are two of the big ones. The last big issue, the last big one I'll point to is a little different in that this is something new that was included in the 4D rule this time. And it's, we added an exemption for the utilization of prescribed fire for grassland management. That wasn't included in the original 4D rule, but the service views that as an essential conservation action for lesser prairie chickens. One that for a lot of reasons, there are a lot of variables that go into it, isn't utilized very much in the range of lesser prairie chicken. And it provides value when it's utilized. And so we wanted to make sure we weren't putting any regulatory burdens in place to further disincentivize the use of prescribed fire when landowners were open to using it. So we did include that this time around that wasn't in the 2014.
Obviously, the overall goal of this entire process would be the preservation of the lesser prairie chicken. Assuming that it does end up being listed here sometime next summer, how do you judge success? I mean, is there a magic number out there that once the bird count hits that, it's delisted? And what's that process look like? Or is this largely going to be permanent?
Yeah. So you think through the process a little bit. One part of our process is, so let's assume just for this discussion that the listing is finalized in about 10 and a half months from now. The next step in that process would be the identification of measurable criteria that it takes to downlist or delist the lesser prairie chicken. We call that the recovery planning process. So shortly after the finalization of a listing, the service has a responsibility as defined by the ESA to start that recovery planning process and say, all right, we understand lesser prairie chicken's not in a good place right now, but here are the measurable criteria it's going to take for us to get to where protections of the ESA are no longer warranted. That would be pre-decisional right now because, again, we're still in the middle of the process. We haven't even determined for sure that it needs to be listed. But, you know, we can say with some confidence that regardless of the listing status, there are a few things that need to occur. Number one is that we can't focus on short-term population trends for this species to indicate success or lack of success because short-term population cycles for lesser prairie chicken are almost entirely driven by precipitation patterns. In good years, when you have average or above average precipitation, populations are going to increase. That's what we've seen largely since 2013, 2014 across the lesser prairie chickens. And we've seen average or above average precipitation largely increasing populations. And we expect to see that. The other thing we expect to see is one thing you can count on in the Southern Great Plains is drought. Drought will occur at some point again. And so we can count on lesser prairie chicken populations decreasing in response to poor precipitation patterns. And so we know, you know, there's going to be the cyclical nature. And the key there is not to overreact based upon a couple of years of increasing populations or overreact based upon a couple of years of decreasing populations. So judging success based upon short-term patterns, you're really setting yourself up for failure. So we need to look at long-term population trajectories, first of all. And the reason I say that is related to my second point, really is what's driving lesser prairie chicken populations is implications to habitat. First of all, the quantity of available habitat. We continue to see available habitat decrease, and it's been decreasing for the last 150 years across the Southern Great Plains. And so we've continually seen decreases in the amount of available habitat, and then the quality of the habitat that exists is being impacted by precipitation. And so for thinking big picture about lesser prairie chicken conservation, it's going to take restoration, and I specifically define restoration as conversion of non-usable habitat to usable habitat. So conversion of non-usable space to space that's now being used by lesser prairie chickens to increase the amount of available habitat out there for lesser prairie chickens. We know that, you know, oil and gas activities, wind energy development, agriculture development, encroachment by woody vegetation, all these things are going to continue to occur. So we're going to continue to see decreases in lesser prairie chicken habitat. The key is to place conservation efforts and try to get those to outweigh the threats on the landscape. And so a great example of this, and I won't spend a ton of time here because we detail it in a lot of in our listing rule there, is the CRP program does a great job at doing that. And when you look at the short grass ecoregion kind of in central Kansas up there that supports 70% of the lesser prairie chicken population right now, if you go back to the 70s, there were very few birds in that ecoregion, very few of any birds in that ecoregion. It was a short grass dominated landscape. A lot of that had been converted over to row crop agriculture. CRP program comes in, does large scale restoration and planting dirt to grass, and specifically planting mixed and tall grass species in there. And you fast forward 20 years later, and all of a sudden that area supports the majority of lesser prairie chickens. And so it's completely doable. Conservation of lesser prairie chickens is doable. It takes a little bit of time and takes some resources and takes applying the right practices in the right places, and we'll get there.
That's it for my questions, Clay. Any final thoughts before we go? Anything that we didn't cover today?
No. Again, just repeat, thank you for the opportunity to talk to you and your listeners. And I think my biggest message is, you know, I understand that some landowners out there have some concerns, and hopefully it means something for me to say that the Fish and Wildlife Service, you know, is here and wants to work with you and try to ensure that we have an accurate understanding of your concerns, first of all, but more importantly, acknowledge that, again, as I said earlier, conservation of the lesser prairie chicken, regardless of the listing status, we fully grasp is 100% reliant upon cooperation with our conservation partners and private landowners. And so private landowners, if I were speaking directly to you, I'd just say that you know, our success relies upon continued cooperation with you. And we don't want to, and we hope to continue to build upon the success we've already had, like I point to in the short grass ecoregion, and broaden that out and get to a good place to where we're providing landowners with the resources they need, but also meeting the conservation needs of lesser prairie chicken.
That's Clay Nichols with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. Clay, thanks for coming on the show today.
Thank you, Greg.
For more on the listing process for the lesser prairie chicken, listen to our Ag Law Briefs webinar at 11 a.m. Monday, July 19th. Go to www.kfb.org and search for Ag Law Briefs to register or watch a recording of the program. That's it for this edition of Inside Ag. Be sure to subscribe on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. From Manhattan, I'm Greg Deering for Kansas Farm Bureau, the voice of agriculture. Inside Ag is made possible by Kansas Farm Bureau members in each of the state's 105 counties. To become a member, visit www.kfb.org/join.